The following is a high five moment from highfivecasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high five moment today? Only at highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
At 9 p.m. on October 30th, 1994, Marcus Boyd and Greg Elking were on Marcus's porch in St. Louis when two men approached them. Both were carrying guns and wearing masks that covered all but their eyes. Greg Elking ran off as shots rang out, and Marcus was killed. Marcus's girlfriend was upstairs and was immediately available to the police. When they asked who might have done it, she claimed that Marcus may have had a drug dispute with his friend, Lamar Johnson. After the only eyewitness, Greg Elking, viewed a photo lineup, a man named Philip Campbell, along with Lamar Johnson, were arrested, and Elking identified both men in a live lineup. Lamar maintained that he had been miles away at the time of the crime, but at trial, the lead detective testified that a round trip to the scene of the crime could have taken Lamar less than 5 minutes, making his guilt plausible. A jailhouse informant also said that he had overheard Lamar confessing to the murder. But the most incriminating testimony of all came from Greg Elking. Although he didn't see the shooters' faces behind their masks, Elking said he recognized Lamar easily because of a distinctive lazy eye. The eyewitness testimony was damning. After all, there couldn't possibly be any incentive for someone to make up something like that. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm Lauren Bright Pacheco, broadcast journalist and host of the podcasts Murder in Oregon, Murder in Illinois, and Murder in Miami. And I am so excited to be filling in for Jason Flom. In today's case, irrefutable evidence of innocence as well as an eventual confession from both of the actual assailants were not enough to receive a new trial. It took 28 years and new legislation for justice to finally be done in the Missouri appellate system. And we are honored to be joined by its survivor, Lamar Johnson. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
It's an honor. And the other half of us refers to Lamar's attorney from Morgan Pilot in Kansas City, who's also on the board of the Midwest Innocence Project. Lindsay Runnels, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So Lamar, if we can just go back, I know that you are 49 now, correct?
Yes.
And this happened when you were 20.
Yes.
So just explain a little bit about who you were at the age of 20, where you were living, what you were doing, and what you were about at that point in your life.
I was kind of like a lot of people from the inner cities at that age. I was working, I was in school, but I was also, you know, trying to hustle a little bit because that was probably the height of the crack era. And so like a lot of kids in the neighborhood, I was trying to make a little money on the side. And of course, that, you know, puts me in the crosshairs of some police officers in my neighborhood.
Yeah. The detective that was leading this investigation, Detective Joseph Nickerson, you know, a longtime veteran by the time he retired of the St. Louis City Police Department. He knew Lamar before. There was this group of young men, the usual suspects for anything that happened within that neighborhood. They were brought in, hauled down to the police station over anything, whether or not they were even just because they were a group of, you know, young black men from the wrong part of town.
And our audience may recall the name Joseph Nickerson from the wrongful conviction of Billy Allen, who continues to languish on federal death row. We'll have his episode linked in the bio so they can further acquaint themselves with Detective Nickerson, who is actually on the St. Louis DA's Do Not Testify list due to credibility issues. And just like Marcus and Lamar, Billy Allen was also dealing drugs, so it seems like Nickerson had a type. Now, Lamar, I understand it was easy for Nickerson to make a connection between you and the victim in this case, Marcus Boyd. Not only were you guys both selling drugs at the time, but you were really close friends. In fact, you were almost like family through a woman named Leslie Williams, who was the mother of Marcus's child.
Yeah, he was dating Leslie Williams, the cousin of Pamela Williams. And I have a daughter by Pamela Williams. Pam and Leslie lived together. So that's how we met, probably about 5 years before then. We just really became close.
Did you have a falling out of sorts before he was murdered?
Marcus and I never had a falling out or an argument. Never.
Yet, an alleged rift between you two over drugs was eventually used as a motive for what happened on October 30th, 1994, at around 9 p.m. At this time, Leslie Williams was in the apartment that she shared with Marcus Boyd, bathing their baby, while Marcus was downstairs on their porch on Louisiana Avenue, and a man named Greg Elking was there to repay Marcus for some crack. So they were talking when two armed men approached in black ski masks that covered everything but their eyes. One ordered Greg off the porch. They fatally shot Marcus and ran off. And obviously, Leslie came running down to the porch.
Then once the shooting started, she ran downstairs and she was able to see the gunman on the porch shooting, but she couldn't make out who they were. And, you know, that's I guess, the routine question that officers ask. They, well, you know, who do you think might have something to do with? And she just, you know, she just said Lamar. She couldn't think of anybody else. She couldn't think of any reason. And she was asked about that. Well, why did you think that? She said, well, I didn't have any reason. They didn't owe each other any money or drugs or anything like that. So I just think that's just my name that came to her mind.
And it would have been very difficult to identify you because both of the gunmen were wearing masks.
That's true.
Plus, you were almost 3 miles away at the time with your youngest daughter and her mother, Erica Barrow, while also handling some business of your own.
Yeah, I got a call from a guy I had just met, and he wanted to purchase some crack. And I arranged to meet him at, you know, a corner of 39th and Lafayette. And it just happens that at that corner, a friend of ours lived at that apartment too. And so I just told Erica to come with us, her and a baby to come with us. And we went to that apartment and so that I could kind of visit the friend and also meet with this person.
And it was during this 5 minute span where your whereabouts could not be accounted for by Erica Barrow that the state eventually alleged that you had sped from Lafayette and 39th Street, picked up the actual other assailant in the case, Philip Campbell, changed into dark clothing, put on masks, pulled up at Marcus's, and killed him in front of his apartment at 3910 Louisiana, which was, what, like 2.7 miles away?
Yeah, 2 to 3 miles away.
And so how long would it have actually taken you to get there and get back, realistically?
I don't know. I know that Lindsay and them have driven that distance. I know the prosecutor's office has driven that. The attorney general's office even drove that distance. And I know that you couldn't have done it in 5 minutes, let alone the 2 to 3 minutes that Detective Nickerson testified at trial that it could have been driven.
Right. A simple Google search sets that distance at 2.7 miles, taking at least 10 minutes by car, making a 20-minute round trip. So pure math. This is impossible. Now, Lamar, this was your really close friend who had just been shot, and I understand you found out about it right away.
Well, I learned after I went out and met with this person and made the deal and came back in, I received a call from my oldest daughter's mother, and she told me that Marcus had been shot. She also said that Marcus's girlfriend had said that she thought that maybe I had something to do with it. And so I asked Leslie, I said, well, what happened to Marcus? And she said he was outside with a white guy and he got shot. And then I asked her, well, did you think I had something to do with him? And she said, yeah. I said, well, why did you think that? And she said, well, I couldn't think of anybody else.
So she didn't see what happened, but for whatever reason, she decided that there was some kind of an issue between you and Marcus, and that started this chain of events, basically.
Essentially, that's what happened, yeah.
And you were already a known entity to the lead detective on this case, Joe Nickerson. So that's all he needed to hear.
I mean, the investigation, for what it was started and ended at the scene that night, honestly. Lamar Johnson's name, you know, is in that first police report from the scene before the eyewitness had even been identified, let alone found and interviewed. And so when a single eyewitness in a case hasn't even been identified by name and they have their suspect, I mean, that's not an investigation designed to find facts, in my view.
And when they located Greg Elking, the eyewitness, a couple of days later, what did he say?
He says what would be expected, knowing the facts of this case, which is, I couldn't identify anybody. I couldn't see. I didn't recognize them. They were masked. I can't help. That's what he's saying when he's first contacted, which makes perfect sense.
But then later that day, Elking and his wife met Nickerson at a diner, and he was shown an array which included Lamar and Philip Campbell. But according to Elking, he made no identification. As it came out later, they had a discussion that somehow changed Elking's mind about what he'd seen. That evening, November 3rd, 1994, Lamar and Philip Campbell were both picked up. Now, during this time, Lamar waived his Miranda rights, spoke to Nickerson, told him where he was across town, and it was impossible for him to have committed the crime. And it was during this time, Lamar was alleged to have spoken to another detective, a Detective Campbell. But Lamar was completely unaware of this alleged conversation until trial. Lamar knew he was innocent, so he agreed to be in the lineup.
Yeah, they bring Greg Elking down to the station, and Lamar is in one of the lineups. There's three fillers just pulled, you know, from the jail to be put into that lineup. And Greg Elking views it at least three times. First time, he can't identify anybody. The second time, he can't identify anybody. The third time, he identifies a filler from the jail, who, of course, everyone knows, not a suspect, and is got the world's greatest alibi, right? He's in custody. The lineup containing Philip Campbell, the co-defendant and an actual perpetrator in this case, he couldn't identify anyone, didn't recognize anyone from that lineup. And of course, within that lineup is somebody that was actually on that porch with Greg Elking. There was no identification made, and not only no identification, an identification of someone else, and it should have been the end of it.
But that, of course, wasn't the end of it. We now know that Greg was told who to identify, and later he did. But take us to what happened immediately after this live lineup.
So when I left out of the lineup room, Detective Nickerson was kind of leaning over a table, and I could tell that he was frustrated. And I remember telling him, see, I told you I didn't do this. And I remember the way that he looked up at me, like he had hatred in his eyes. That's the only way that I know how to describe it. But I left there knowing that I hadn't been identified. And when they came back later and said, well, you've been identified, I knew then that something was going on, that something was wrong.
Greg Elking's testimony on this is clear. He was told the numbers of the lineup. You know, it's three and it's four. Three, of course, was Lamar's position, and four was Philip Campbell's position. And, you know, the train left the station right then.
This episode is underwritten by global law firm Greenberg Traurig. Through its pro bono program, Greenberg Traurig leverages its more than 2,600 lawyers across 44 offices to serve the greater good of our communities and provide equal access to justice for all. In the field of criminal justice, Greenberg Traurig attorneys have exonerated and freed a man in Philadelphia, represent numerous individuals previously sentenced to life for crimes committed as juveniles in resentencing hearings, and received the American Bar Association's 2021 Exceptional Service Award for death penalty representation for their work on 5 death penalty cases. GT is reimagining what big law can be because a more just world only happens by design.
So they took me and Philip down to the booking area, which was the central holdover. And there's a 20-hour period where the circuit attorney's office makes a decision on whether or not to actually charge you. And the jailer came that next day and said that charges had been issued.
And while you and Philip Campbell were in that holding area, enter in a jailhouse snitch named William. Hmm. Can you tell me a little bit, Lindsay, about William Mock?
Well, William Mock had been an informant before, but, you know, the tall tale that he told in Lamar's case was that while he was in custody in this city holdover area, and that's that place in the jail where people are held before charges are issued, it's a long line of more than 10 cells housing up to, you know, 15 folks, loud folks, people coming off of drugs. And that's where they were at this particular period. They're never celled together. And William Mock claims to hear Lamar and Philip yelling to each other through this holding area, basically confessing to this, saying things like, you know, oh, we shouldn't have let the white guy live. And, you know, we got to, you know, hide the gun. And, you know, he's claiming, he, Mock, that he's hearing this and he's hearing Lamar yelling out, not only, hey, I'm Lamar Johnson. My name is Lamar. And here's my information to a Lamont.
It's so absurd. It's so absurd.
It's absurd, even if, you know, this Lamont person had been in there, right? But there's not a Lamont in that jail when William Mock is in there talking about these instances. They knew Lamont wasn't in there. Lamar's lawyer brings it up at trial.
And that his testimony was incentivized.
Of course, as they are, right? I mean, jailhouse snitches don't work for free. And this particular one certainly did it. But Lamar's jury, Lamar, no one knew that William Mock had a history of doing this exact same thing just 2 years before he did it in this case.
Since then, letters that Mock wrote to Nickerson and the prosecutor have been obtained, letters that were written from prison after his own probation had been revoked, in which he was offering his services in exchange for freedom. And not only were his motivations for testifying exposed in his letters to the prosecutor, but also in his letters to Nickerson, Mock's overt racism was on full display.
Yes, he's writing his letters as, again, as snitches do, saying, this is what I want, and calling Lamar and Phil, his co-defendant, you know, two-bit N-word, and, you know, a number of other comments. And that's important because it shows, of course, his bias, his motivation for doing some of this, which is why under the rules that would have to be disclosed so that the jury can test that bias. And, you know, that was one of our strongest Brady claims in the case, that these letters weren't disclosed to Lamar or the jury.
So let's talk about the trial, which began July 10th, 1995 in St. Louis County Circuit Court. The prosecutor was Assistant Circuit Attorney Dwight Warrant, and Lamar, your public defender was David Bruns. One of the key points brought up at trial was Greg Elking's eyewitness identification, in which he said that he recognized you in the lineup because of your, quote, lazy eye.
That's true.
Which is bizarre because I'm looking right at you, sir, and you do not have a lazy eye. So what was all of that about?
Well, so that's confusing because he doesn't verify identification in the photo spread. He actually identifies somebody else in the lineup. And it's only after he had spent some time alone with Detective Nickerson that he suddenly said, oh, I know who did it. It was number 3 and number 4. And then in the police report, he says that he's could identify me based on a lazy or crooked eye. I don't know where that came from. I'd never heard that before in my entire life. That's the first time that it's mentioned, which is, of course, when he needs some sort of means of justifying an identification.
I'm sure they knew that this case is weak. And so we're going to have to explain how somebody makes an identification of fully masked black men at dark, you know, and Dwight Warren said that at the hearing, right? There was no case without this identification because, as Lamar said, no physical evidence, no motive was ever investigated or presented because there was no motive for Lamar to kill Marcus. So Greg Elking's identification was central. And so when he pointed to Lamar in front of that jury and said, that's the guy, I was on the porch and that's him. I mean, it was the key.
But you found out much later after your conviction that Elking had been incentivized to lie about identifying you. And that after the trial, he'd even tried to come forward with the truth.
Well, I eventually was able to get in contact with Greg, and by then he had already written his pastor and had been trying to come forward. He just wanted to do the right thing. And he just wrote out everything that had occurred. He told that he had, you know, him and his family were suffering financially, and that as an incentive, he had received money, new apartment, and they had utilities that was taken care of. And I mean, everything that he said is eventually we was able to corroborate all the way down to they're taking care of traffic tickets for him. That's just how detailed it was.
Unfortunately, no one was aware of Greg Elking's motivations at trial, nor was anyone besides the prosecutor aware of William Mock's motivations, which were not only racist, but were also entirely motivated by gaining his freedom.
Mock had also claimed, in addition to me supposedly talking with this Lamont about killing a white witness in this case, I was supposed to have also robbed and killed some other white guy. And it just split the trial up. And for most of that whole second day, because of this false other case that Mock had came up with, this just began to talk about that imaginary case, which police had to eventually admit that they looked for this case and it never even happened.
They're being asked on the stand in front of the jury, well, did you investigate this other supposed robbery and homicide of a white guy on the South Side? Yeah, we did. What'd you find? There's no case. So here we are yet again, that they have a very big important fact that William Mock is pretending to have overheard, that they know it doesn't exist. The case is not real.
And that wasn't the only false testimony that was submitted. There was also an alleged confession from Lamar on the day he was arrested before the lineup to a detective, Ralph Campbell, no relation to Philip Campbell, in which he was alleged to say, I shouldn't have let the white guy live. Another conversation that never took place, and the fabrications and misinformation don't end there. At trial, a ski mask was introduced that actually had been found in Lamar's car during a traffic stop. But the problem with this ski mask was when it was found in Lamar's car.
Yeah, it was 2 months before Marcus was killed. And that mask was put in my car by a friend of mine, a guy that I knew.
Yeah, at one of the many times he was curbed, as they call it, in, you know, St. Louis, where they pull up on you and search your car. That happened in August. You know, they came, they took it from the trunk of Lamar's car, along with a number of other items, and packaged and put into police custody down in the property lockers in August of 1994, where it sat and where it was on the night of October 30th. So they knew it could never have been used. And it's sitting there on counsel table as a, you know, exhibit for all to see. And, you know, it's one of the many, in my view, really intentionally prejudicial things. It's completely irrelevant to this case.
100%. Now, your trial attorney, David Bruns, did point that out, as well as the fact that you did not have a lazy eye. Your girlfriend, Erica Barrow, testified you were almost 3 miles away from the scene, adding that you were only out of her sight for 5 minutes. But Detective Nickerson rebutted your alibi, testifying that he had driven that route 20 to 50 times, saying that Lamar could have made the trip in no more than 5 minutes. This testimony was left unchecked. So your alibi was rebutted. They've got Elking's identification, Mock's overheard confession, and Detective Campbell offering an alleged confession as well. So how long did the jury deliberate?
They deliberated for an hour and a half. They came back in. And as most people know, if the jury's not looking at you, that's a bad sign. And none of them looked at me. And I think it was the clerk that read the verdict. Everything was kind of a blur back then. And they said I was guilty, first degree murder and armed criminal action.
What went through your body? What went through your head?
I didn't know how to react. I just couldn't believe that a jury would believe that. It was no motive ever presented, no physical evidence for it. So I was stunned. I was stunned.
Now, this is what really got me, because between the time of your conviction and sentencing, something insane happens. And Lindsay, can you address that?
Yeah, the verdict came down on July 5th of 1995. And Phil Campbell knows, of course, that Lamar had nothing to do with this. And they start writing letters back and forth to each other, Lamar and Phil Campbell. And Phil Campbell is saying, I know you didn't do this. It's really screwed up that you got convicted when it was me and B.A., James Howard, his nickname. And I'm sorry, man, but, you know, that's how the game goes and we can't tell on B.A., our friend. And Lamar writing back saying, you know, you guys got to help me tell the truth on this. Lamar finally writes to Judge Shaw, his trial judge, and the judge who's getting ready to sentence him. He says, I'm getting these letters from my co-defendant. I didn't do this. Somebody help me, basically. Asking for help in the way that he knows how to do it. Dwight Warren, the prosecutor in this case, applies for a search warrant. Lo and behold, here are all the letters that Lamar's been talking about. They're filed on the court docket. They're put into the record. They're the basis of a motion for a new trial. And it is completely and utterly ignored by everybody.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Woo!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and I want to let you know about my new immersive BBC Radio 4 podcast series, Deep Calm. It's all about how to tap into and activate a remarkable system that we all have hardwired inside of us, our relaxation response. And it's been developed to be listened to at any time you want to really unwind. I hope you'll listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
What are you looking for in a new smart TV? 4K picture quality? High quality and immersive sound? A sleek design? All of those are givens, but only the new Roku Pro Series has all of those and the Roku streaming experience and award-winning OS. Get fast, easy access to all your apps like iHeart, where you can stream all your favorite music, radio, and podcasts all day. And regular all-inclusive trips to Roku City. The new Roku Pro Series, a smart TV built by the streaming pros.
Not only did Campbell acknowledge that you had nothing to do with it, he cut a deal for 7 years. They knew that he was guilty and he's serving less time than you are. And they know you're wrongfully convicted. But if I'm not mistaken, Campbell had two affidavits, one in 96 and then another one shortly before he died in 2009, correct?
Right.
And James Howard, or B.A., the man Campbell named as his accomplice, also signed affidavits stating that Lamar was innocent. In fact, he did so on three different occasions between 2002 and 2009.
So that's why we got multiple affidavits over the years. And I was constantly trying to present those to the courts, and they just weren't heard.
So now we know that two people, the people who were actually responsible for the murder, came forward not once, but multiple times, and confessed to it and said you had nothing to do with it. I cannot imagine how you must have felt, like punching air, thinking that every single time you can prove your innocence. And it's falling not just on deaf ears, but it's being completely ignored.
Right.
And you're 20 when you went in. You were sentenced to life without parole, and you had two young daughters, right. And months turned to years, which turned into decades.
Decades, yes.
You gave an interview that actually broke my heart, that you said that you had never been to the beach and you had never been on a plane.
Right.
What was it like watching the time that you had spent in prison exceed the time that you had lived outside of prison?
The biggest thing was just the relationships with my daughters that I lost. You know, I wasn't able to develop the type of bond with them that, you know, most fathers have with their daughters. I guess just the relationship with family and children, that's the thing that hurts the most.
What kept you going?
The truth. I knew that if ever I could be heard, I believe that any fair and impartial person would, they would have any choice to find that I was, at least didn't receive a fair trial. But I knew that they could find that I was actually innocent. Because to deny it, you would have to step over a lot of things. You'd have to ignore a lot of stuff. You'd have to ignore the confessions. You'd have to ignore the trial I received. You'd have to ignore what we knew about Mock. I mean, when you've got one thing after another, it's just hard to say that none of this is the truth.
So, Lindsay, let's fast forward to 2014, which I believe is around the time you and your firm, Morgan Pilot, got involved in Lamar's case, along with the Midwest Innocence Project. And one of the things you were trying to do is to verify what Lamar had heard from Greg Elking, that he received financial compensation from St. Louis for giving false testimony. And so you were trying to confirm the existence of those payments.
Yeah, he was telling Lamar through his letters, they paid me, they did this, they did that. And Lamar was requesting of the Attorney General's office, the Circuit Attorney's office, the St. Louis City Police Department, the Victims Crime Fund. We were writing and asking, where are the documents showing compensation to this particular witness? And the responses overwhelmingly were, there are no records. What you're asking for does not exist, or ignored us and didn't respond at all.
But then in 2017, Kimberly Gardner became the new St. Louis Circuit Attorney. And a year later, she forms the St. Louis Conviction Integrity Unit. What happened when you brought your request to them?
She directed them to investigate. And in February of 2019, Tony Box, one of her employees, found the documents, 60 plus pages of them, showing more than $4,1994 of compensation to Greg Elking and his family. So it wasn't until right before the filing of the motion for new trial in the city of St. Louis that the actual documents were produced that corroborated Mr. Elking.
And in July of 2019, Circuit Attorney Gardner filed a motion for a new trial. All of this evidence is presented, the affidavits from Campbell and Howard, the compensation to Elking, proof of William Mock's unreliability. And at that hearing, Kim Gardner recommends that Lamar be granted a new trial. That should have been the turning point for you, Lamar.
Yeah, I mean, I was hopeful that that would be enough. I mean, I don't know what else you could have that would justify relief in this case. But unfortunately, the judge that it was assigned to had a different position or belief. She said she didn't have any authority to act in the case except to deny.
Because at that time, Missouri law said that outside of the initial appeal, what is known as a 2915 in Missouri, which happens within 90 days of trial, where you can raise any issues, ineffective assistance, Brady violations, new evidence, etc. After that period, neither the prosecutor nor the trial court has the authority to challenge the conviction. So, I mean, Lamar, even with the circuit attorney and virtually all the evidence on your side, the system still failed you. But rather than the end of the road, you and your team saw this as a challenge, and you made the decision to take this fight all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court. Lindsay, what made you want to take this case forward? Did you feel like you could actually win?
So we knew it was going to be an uphill battle, but Circuit Attorney Gardner was, you know, at that time, the only prosecutor that was willing to test the bounds of this and highlight the real gap in Missouri law here. And we had long conversations about that with Mr. Johnson, you know, saying test litigation is important, but can be real pain in it because, you know, sometimes you must lose in a very public way before things can change. His case was chosen because of the strength of these facts. This innocence case is unimpeachable. Like, it has it all at every level where there was supposed to be some protection for an accused person. The system fell apart in this case. Nonetheless, the questions before the Supreme Court had nothing to do with those amazing facts. It was, is he too late for justice? Whatever that means. And is Missouri law big enough to recognize that a prosecutor, no matter when she comes into information, credible, reliable, and corroborated, that a conviction obtained by her office is false? Does she have the authority and the duty to do something about it? Those were the questions.
And when it came time to decide those questions?
The Supreme Court, in a gutting decision, said no. Under Missouri law today, there is no such mechanism. And for that reason, and that reason alone, Lamar Johnson's motion and petition for new trial are denied. However, in this opinion, you know, they called on the legislature. We agree with Mr. Johnson and Ms. Gardner. This is unfortunate. It's worse than that. But Lamar Johnson's case had garnered so much national attention that people were having the reaction that you had, which is, how does this happen in the United States of America that a prosecutor goes to court and says this person's innocent, yet here he sits in custody? All of that mattered because the legislature that had been unwilling, uninterested, passed legislation in record speed. That opinion came down on March 2nd, 2021. And with 6 weeks left of session, it was passed. But it was because of the way we lost, in my view.
And then on August 28th, 2021, please tell me what law was enacted in Missouri.
The Johnson Fix was signed by Governor Parson in one of the reddest of red states in all the land. And now a prosecutor in Missouri, whether in the city of St. Louis or in an outstate rural county, can go to court at any time, whether it's 10 years or 25 or 28, and go to court and say, our office made a mistake. I'm here to fix that.
And I believe one of the first to be exonerated under the Johnson Fix was Kevin Strickland, right, whose wrongful conviction was overturned in November of 2021 after he had spent 43 years in prison.
And there's others pending. He will not be the last. There's no doubt. And what a legacy for Lamar to leave. And we were so happy that it would help others. That was the whole point of it.
And we've seen the same issue in another case that we've covered on this podcast, Ken Middleton. His trial judge, Edith Messina, granted him a new trial in 2004, but this issue halted that new trial on appeal. Now his current district attorney, Jean Peters Baker, who has acknowledged Ken's innocence, even with this new statute, refuses to act. We'll have his episode linked in the bio. So with this law in place, Kim Gardner filed a new motion repeating the claims made in the previous filing. And Judge David Mason held 5 days of hearings in December of 2022. And there is this wonderful moment from those hearings where Judge Mason is questioning Detective Nickerson about your non-existent lazy eye, Lamar. I want to quote from it because it's just a masterclass in dismantling a witness on the stand. So basically, the judge was asking whether this lazy eye identification was enough, that even if Nickerson thought that, you know, Lamar, you had a lazy eye, which you do not, that this is the exact quote from that exchange. Judge Mason, you didn't think you needed to dig any further. Nickerson, dig into what? Judge Mason, maybe a little more corroboration, something that could corroborate a little more than just the eye. Nickerson, well, Mr. Johnson matched the height, weight, and age of what the witness had given. And Judge Mason says, that gentleman back there does too. You want to arrest him? I mean, I probably didn't do it justice, but it really is worth watching. It's epic. You can find it on YouTube. In fact, we will link to it in the bio. And then on February 14th, 2023, Valentine's Day, Judge Mason found you factually innocent and vacated the conviction. You walked out of the courtroom that day a free man. Take me to that moment.
It just felt like a heavy weight was being lifted. It's just the weight of like losing a close friend of mine, the weight of everything I'd lost over the last 28 years. It was just slowly lifting. And I was coming to believe that it actually was true. So that's how I felt.
Can you tell me a little bit about your life today?
Well, it's been fast. The Innocence Project, working with a very generous firm and people who kind of loaned me an apartment to try to, you know, get me started. And I can actually take some time and decide what I want to do and how I can best use this experience to try to, you know, help others who are either going through it or help them to avoid going through it. And that's ultimately what I want to do, is to just do my part in trying to make the system better, because it can be better.
And have you been connecting with your daughters?
Absolutely. My daughter is going to get married next month, and she wants me to walk her down the aisle. And I think that's something that every father looks forward to doing. So I'm very grateful for the timing. Oh, and my other daughter, she's engaged too. So I get a double daddy duty.
That's wonderful. And if any of our listeners want to help support you in getting your life restarted, I know that the Midwest Innocence Project has set up a GoFundMe page for you, and we'll have links to that in the episode bio. So at this point, we have something on the podcast called Closing Arguments. And first of all, I want to thank you so much, both of you, for spending this time with me. It's just a mind-blowing, heartbreaking, and yet very inspiring story. And I commend both of you for your perseverance and your resilience and your fight, really. If I could ask you guys to make your closing arguments in terms of what your takeaway is from your experience, and I'll ask you, Lindsay, to go first.
You know, the motto of the Johnson team, which included so many incredible advocates at the Midwest Innocence Project in Lathrop and our little, you know, army, I guess, would continually tell the press, tell ourselves, the truth always finds a way, you know? And there were moments where we were amongst ourselves wondering if that was really true, if our mantra was going to be proven, you know, this was going to be right. And the deep relief that I have that it has restored some of that old faith and fire that I had before, because this system is a brilliant and beautiful system that we have. The Constitution provides everything that we need to ensure reliability, to ensure fairness, to conduct trials in a way that honors, you know, this uniquely American idea that is a really beautiful thing to be proud of. But the things that freed Lamar Johnson existed in 1994 for him. The Sixth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, all of those things that are just brilliant protectors of these life and liberty and fairness and against overreach. Those things existed, but the levers weren't working. The people in charge weren't doing their job. This case couldn't have gone worse. At every single stop along the road, it failed. Every check, every safety valve that's built into this system failed in this case. And on the second time around, it took too long, but it did work. And what happened out of it was the shining, the crown jewel of the American system, which is, it is touchstone of due process, truth, fairness, and all of that righteousness. It took too long. It took too much. We should be ashamed. We should be angry. We should be motivated, but we should be proud still of this system, that it can do it if we demand it. And we need folks to get in the game and demand it of their elected officials, of their prosecutors, of their state officials. I mean, it's the voters that demand this stuff. And this system's worth fighting for. It can get it right. It can do great things. And it did it in this case. Finally.
Oh, I would start by repeating what Lindsay said. It is true. I believe the truth will find a way. In the end, you know, the people can lie about it, deny it, or try to hide it, but it's there. It's going to come out. What I guess what I would add is that is gratitude. I mean, in spite of all that has happened and all the bad things that happened, there's still a lot to be grateful for in the end. And that's what I choose to hold on to at this point in my life. No, I mean, I've always said that just holding on to that anger, it's just trading one prison for another. And I've given too much of my time to that. And I would, anybody who's going through that struggle of what I went through, there's hope. They should be comforted in that, and that my case is a testament of what can happen.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'm your guest host, Lauren Bright Pacheco. I'd like to thank executive producers Jason Flom and Kevin Wardis for inviting me to be here. Special thanks also to our wonderful production team, Connor Hall, Annie Chelsea, Lila Robinson, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production comes from 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as Lava for Good on all 3 platforms. You can find me online at Lauren Bright Pacheco, and you can find my podcasts, Murder in Oregon, Murder in Illinois, and my latest, Murder in Miami, wherever you listen to podcasts. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
High Five Casino is a social casino with real prizes and big Vegas hits at highfivecasino.com. The hottest games right from Vegas, and all winnings go straight to your bank account. Hundreds of exclusive games, free daily rewards, and come back to get free coins every 4 hours. Only at highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details at high5casino.com.
High Five Casino.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
What are you looking for in a new smart TV? 4K picture quality? High quality and immersive sound? A sleek design? All of those are givens, but only the new Roku Pro Series has all of those and the Roku streaming experience and award-winning OS. Get fast, easy access to all your apps like iHeart, where you can stream all your favorite music, radio, and podcasts all day. And regular all-inclusive trips to Roku City. The new Roku Pro Series. A smart TV built by the streaming pros.